Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's speech today at the UN, where he urged world leaders to speak out forcibly against violence and extremism, pointedly saying in reference to the killing of the American diplomats because of an obscure, bigoted film, that there is no speech that justifies mindless violence. Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern history at the University of Michigan, joins us to discuss today's activity at the UN and his latest article at Truthdig, Muslims Are No Different, or Why Bill Maher's Blood Libel is Bigotry. Then we will speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David K. Johnston about his new book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. And since David has been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States, we'll also discuss Mitt Romney's latest tax return and the ones he has refused to release, in particular 2009. Then finally, with Obama telling the UN that the US would do what we must to stop Iran getting nuclear weapons, and Ahmadinejad calling Israel a fake regime that would be eliminated, we will examine the gradual elimination of policy options to avoid war between the United States and Iran. Dr. Trita Parsi, the president of the National Iranian American Council, joins us to discuss the three ways a war could begin. He has an article at opendemocracy.net, The U.S. and Iran on a Dead-End Path to War. And joining us now is Juan Cole, a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan and president of the Global Americana Institute. He's the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt Invading the Middle East and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com and has an article at Truthdig, Muslims Are No Different, or Why Bill Maher's Blood Libel is Bigotry. Welcome to Background Briefing, Juan Cole.
Thanks so much.
And the president was speaking today before the United Nations. He sort of used the speech in effect, bookending it by talking about the U.S. diplomat that was killed in Libya, Christopher Stevens, and saying that our future will be determined by people like Christopher Stevens and not by his killers. What was your sense of whether it was resonating with the audience there? There seemed to be some confusion amongst the audience as to why the U.S. Has this First Amendment that allows the kind of incitement that we've seen that's resulted from this obscure film.
Right. Well, of course, it is true that in many parts of the world, the United States First Amendment is unthinkable, and governments do control what can be seen in public spaces, on TV, on the Internet. And so in societies like that, the assumption is that the U.S. government could do something about a blasphemous and distasteful film if it wanted to. On the other hand, I think a lot of people in the Arab world are pretty sophisticated and recognize that the U.S. Can't do anything about it. And it should be remembered that despite very severe censorship regimes throughout the Arab world, hackers and activists found ways to get the word out about demonstrations and to ridicule leaders like Hosni Mubarak and Zinedine Ben Ali in Tunisia. So I think a lot of people know what the score is.
So is there a kind of sick kind of symmetry here between the handful of bigots like Robert Spencer, David Horowitz, Pamela Geller, and these people behind this film? That once, you know, Geller's got these posters up now in the MTA in New York and apparently in San Francisco, these bigoted posters, their influence is obviously disproportionate to the mayhem that they provoke. But my understanding is, for example, in Pakistan, that the majority of the people there are kind of appalled at the idea that about, you know, 10% of the country are sort of, you know, fundamentalists who take to the streets on any opportunity and shut down the entire country. So I'm wondering here whether there is a possibility of a kind of backlash in the way that there was a backlash in Libya against those that killed the ambassador when they went after the militia, the citizens of Benghazi.
Oh, well, it's a canny point. And in fact, I'd go even further, Ian. The Cairo embassy protest was a couple thousand people in a city of 20 million. And in Cairo, if you call a demonstration and only a couple thousand people show up, I mean, that's considered a huge failure. In Pakistan, the only crowds that really took up this point were relatively small, and they belonged to the fundamentalist Jamaat-e-Islami, the Muslim fundamentalist party, which, when it runs for office, because it's a party, it typically gets 3 to 5% of the vote. And so, you know, in a place like Pakistan, it's not even necessary for the people to drive these guys out because they're not in power in the first place. They're not that influential. And most people don't particularly like Taliban types. In Pakistani Islam has a lot of singing in it and some dancing sometimes, and shrines of Sufis, all of those things that the hardline fundamentalists hate are typical of Pakistani Islam. So there's no love lost among most Pakistanis for these kinds of fundamentalists. And it's one of the things I live with the cross of trying to explain to Americans that Pakistanis aren't actually fundamentalists for the most part.
Well, that's not to say that there's not a lot of Sunni and Shia violence within the country. And also, it's a bit puzzling to understand the motives of the Pakistani military in wanting the, apparently wanting the Taliban to be installed in Afghanistan, where the U.S. will eventually leave, and most people predict a civil war. But if the Taliban were to become the next regime in Afghanistan, wouldn't that have the effect of encouraging the Pakistani version of the Taliban?
Or making people in Pakistan even more afraid of them.
Right. That's the other way to look at it, yeah. So what's your sense then of why it is that we have these ideas that a handful of these religious fanatics are so influential and so powerful, and we've basically been swept up in this ridiculous overreaction to this ridiculously obscure film? Is that's basically the point you're making? Is that there's no context to this discussion that's taking place?
Absolutely. Well, you know, when we analyze American politics and we think, well, why did, you know, Mitt Romney or Barack Obama say something, we tend to think, well, he's playing to his base, or he's trying to expand, you know, his appeal beyond his base, or there's some reason for which they have taken a position. And when we come to discuss someone like Mohamed Morsi, the president of Egypt, and why he was slow to condemn the embassy demonstrations in Cairo, where the American flag was taken down and burned, you know, it's never the case that we stop and think, well, why exactly was he slow? And it seems obvious to me that he is from the Muslim Brotherhood, from a fundamentalist party. He's in danger of being outflanked by people to his right, sort of the Egyptian equivalent of the Tea Party. And so he has to be careful, you know, both to keep correct relations with the U.S., but also to not to offend his base. And his base are very upset about this film. But it should be said about the so-called film is it doesn't seem to be much of a film. It was made under false pretenses, dubbed with the name of the Prophet Muhammad after the actors had all been done with it. And it hasn't really been, you know, it's been shown once in one Dowdy theater in L.A. And then the trailer for it made no splash until it was translated into Arabic. And the people behind this film clearly reached out to the Salafis and the most easily offended groups in Egypt in hopes of provoking them. So this was a plot. I mean, the people who made this film are connected to Pamela Geller, and we don't have any proof of this, but it needs looking into as to whether there wasn't a deliberate attempt by the network. We know there's a network of Islamophobes, of people who hate Muslims in the United States, kind of a latter-day Ku Klux Klan that gets $40 million a year from foundations like the Mellons Gay Foundation and others to promote hatred of Islam. Whether this network was behind this film and was deliberately hoping for violence on the eve of the presidential election in the United States, maybe hoping for embassy officials to be taken hostage, as happened to Jimmy Carter in Iran. And I think it may be much more sinister than simply somebody making a film that was found offensive. I think it may have been a deliberate attempt to get the Muslims goat over in the Middle East in a way that might play into the hands of the American right.
Well, you know, the people around Juan Cole, the people around Romney are completely cynical, and Romney himself is just a serial liar. Now, Mukasey, the former Attorney General, apparently he's floating this idea that he's put out now that Obama is planning on releasing the blind Sheikh Rahman, who's responsible for the first World Trade Center bombing. So there, I think that your point's well taken. There's a machinery out there that's trying to create trouble, aren't they?
Yes, I think so. And they didn't actually get as much trouble as they were hoping for, nor the kind of trouble they were hoping for the most part. And even in Libya, where things went very bad, and we did have four embassy personnel killed, including the ambassador, the people of Benghazi were so upset that this small group of a few dozen fanatics took this step against the U.S. consulate that they then attacked the headquarters of the militias in Benghazi and drove them out of the city. So, you know, that's a headline that I think since 9/11, Americans have been waiting for to see that, you know, angry Muslim crowds attack al-Qaeda and drive them out.
Right. Again, I'm speaking with Juan Cole, Professor of Modern Middle Eastern and South Asian History at the University of Michigan. His latest book is Engaging the Muslim World, and he's the author of the blog Informed Comment at juancole.com, and he also has an article at Truthdig, Muslims Are No Different, or Why Bill Maher's Blood Libel is Bigotry. Let's talk a bit about your article at Truthdig. What is this about Bill Maher and his bigotry? I missed what he said, but yeah. You've pretty much said you've obviously been watching him for some time and think that he is an anti-Muslim. He's anti-Muslim and he's soft on the hardline Israelis. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, Bill Maher is an irreverent guy, and he's a comic, and we all kind of love Bill Maher. But there's something a little bit sinister about some of his blind spots, and one of them is that he just his body language, his comments show that although he hates religion in general, and one understands that, and I respect it. But he really, really despises Islam and I think Muslims. So, you know, he had Keith Ellison on, one of two Muslims, Muslim Americans in Congress, and he was just personally very, very distasteful towards him. And he has people, you know, from the Israeli right wing on, from the Likud party, also, who are in coalition with the Haredim and the most religious factions in Israel, and which sometimes try to make laws that affect secular people, and despite them being part of the Israeli right, he fawns on them, and his body language is very different. But the thing that really set me off was on Friday, Bill Maher said that half of Muslims approve of killing someone who criticized the Prophet Muhammad. And you know, he's accusing people, half of Muslims, of having homicidal tendencies. And this is a blood libel. You know, the thing I object to most in it is this kind of sentiment that Muslims are, you know, one step away from being murderers, that they're different from other people, and is that it's exactly the same kind of libel that was launched for centuries by Western Christians against Jews. Jews were accused of stealing Christian children and killing them and using their blood in rituals. This is a blood libel. And it sounds, you know, bizarre and ridiculous, but, you know, Jews all through the medieval period and into the modern one, you know, were victims of riots and pogroms by angry Christian mobs who were convinced that some child had disappeared and that it was the Jews who did it. So, you know, Jews were configured by Europeans as murderers, as child murderers, and it is a horrible libel and completely untrue. But lots of people died over it, and you know, the hatred for Jews that it cultivated is, in some ways, you know, feeds into the Holocaust. So, for Marr to say that Muslims want to kill people, half of all Muslims want to kill people over a slight to their religion, is a very similar kind of thing. I mean, I don't know of any Muslim who has killed anybody in the United States because the Prophet Muhammad was criticized. I mean, it's just completely untrue that people are acting in this way.
Well, I, as you point out in your article at Truthdig, Juan Cole, that no religion has a monopoly on religious violence. India, dozens of Christians have been killed by Hindu fundamentalists. In Myanmar, angry Buddhists have attacked the hapless Muslim minority. In Sri Lanka, Buddhists have attacked the Tamils, Christians. And perhaps what is going on here in the context of President Obama's speech at the UN calling on global leaders to speak out forcibly against violence and extremism is not so much that a movie has caused a lot of the world, the Islamic and Muslim world, to hate the United States as much as they do, and that's probably exaggerated. But still, look what we've done. You know, we attacked a country on the basis of weapons of mass destruction that they didn't have. We connected it to 9/11, which was a complete lie. And we basically occupied and devastated the country for 8.5 years, resulting in the deaths of perhaps hundreds of thousands and the woundings of millions and the displacement of millions. So perhaps those are the reasons why people are angry at us.
Yeah, well, you know, there is anger over those things. And you know, it's very clever of the West to organize its killings and hate campaigns under the cloak of an organized state with an army. But you know, the final results are even more devastating than a few crowd riots. But you know, I don't have a problem with someone saying that religious people are too touchy, that religion often is used and manipulated as ways of flipping crowds into violence, and that the Salafi Muslims who attacked U.S. embassies in Cairo and Tunisia and the consulate in Libya were wrong and despicable and fanatics. I mean, I don't have a problem with any of that. But saying that the Muslims are peculiar, that they're more violent and homicidal than anybody else in the world, that's the definition of bigotry. I mean, you're singling out one group and stereotyping it. It may be that things set off Muslims that don't set off other groups, but all groups are prone to crowd violence. And, you know, the Haredim in Israel have rioted and burned buildings over issues of things like control of religious shrines. So I insist that all human beings are equidistant from good and bad, and that no group has a monopoly on that, and we're all equally bad in that way. We all can be set off in very irrational and negative ways, so I object to this singling out of Muslims, and especially, you know, in the United States, where there are these campaigns to stop Muslims from building mosques, from having community centers.
And laws have been passed to prevent a mythical takeover of our law by Sharia law. I agree. We've run out of time here, Juan, but I thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Juan Cole, Professor of Modern Middle Eastern and South Asian History at the University of Michigan and President of the Global Americana Initiative. He was the author of Sacred Space and Holy War, The Ayatollahs and Democracy in Iraq, Napoleon's Egypt, Invading the Middle East, and Engaging the Muslim World. He's also the author of the blog Inform Comment at juancole.com and has an article at Truthdig, Muslims Are No Different, or Why Bill Maher's Blood Libel is Bigotry. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with David K. Johnston about his new book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind.
Messages, victims, and Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. You can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept, you know.
Is on release. Now it's through this world I ramble. I see lots of funny men. Some will rob you with a six gun, some with a fountain pen. But it's through your life.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David K. Johnston, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. His most recent books, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, were New York Times bestsellers. He was a reporter for the New York Times for 13 years and now teaches at Syracuse University's College of Law and the Whitman School of Management, and was recently elected board president of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. His latest book just out is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, Ian, thanks for having me.
And I'm very grateful for your book, because I've been railing a lot lately in interviews about broadband. You know, here we are in the United States. We invented the internet, and we're slipping further and further behind the rest of the world in internet speed. We're down to 29th in the world, you know, beside Bulgaria. And at the same time, we pay more and more for our internet, cable, and TV. And just by contrast, the city of Chattanooga, Tennessee, laid fiber optic cables and have everybody in Chattanooga gets a public utility of the best broadband in the world. And I'm so glad that you've come up with a book that, among many other examples, shows how corporate America is just reaming consumers and citizens.
Well, indeed, one of the things that's happened, because the news media hasn't been paying any attention to the regulatory agencies, whereas corporate America has huge staffs that work these agencies thoroughly, and they've succeeded in a number of states in radically cutting the staff that was there to represent the public, to act on behalf of the public. They have developed rules now that have created this terrible situation where our economy is being held back. One of the reasons we have such serious problems with jobs is that our internet is, well, we're 10 or 15 countries below Moldavia in our internet, and large parts of America will never get, under current law, the kind of internet that exists everywhere in France, everywhere in South Korea, everywhere in a number of countries. And we need to recognize that just as in the early 19th century, canals and railroads were the key to economic growth, that having a really fast internet, something blindingly faster than what you see advertised on TV, and by that I mean 20 to 100 times faster, is what's crucial to having a robust economy with lots of jobs in the 21st century.
So your new book, The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Let me just quote some of the statistics about what we're talking about. Telephone companies collect $360 billion in rate increases over the last two decades, and we've slipped from being number one in internet speed down to 29th in the world. Americans pay four times as much as the French for an internet triple play package. That's phone, cable TV, and internet. At $38 per month versus $160 per month that we pay here to these essentially monopolies, either Time Warner or Comcast. The French get global free calling, worldwide live television, and their internet is 10 times faster than ours. And by one measure, Americans pay 38 times as much as the Japanese for internet service. So again, I guess it's like healthcare. The average American doesn't know how much better off the rest of the world is.
Well, yes. And, you know, that's one of the things that's very troubling. We have all these politicians who run around and say, America is the greatest. And everybody's supposed to say, America is the greatest. Well, you know, like Will McAvoy, the fictional character in HBO's Newsroom, I'm going to say, it's not true. And until we recognize that it's not true and that we're not getting the rules right, we are going to be worse and worse off. And it's really, these are really core issues. I go through how all of the utilities, electric, natural gas, oil for pipelines, water, telephone, internet, cable, all of them are being used to charge super high prices for unbelievably bad service, that the rest of the world has figured out ways to regulate these things, or they run them as public services, that is, they're either nonprofit or government-owned. And in America, those places where we have nonprofit or government-owned utilities have the best services at the lowest price. And we need to fundamentally recognize what we're doing here. And here's how determined these companies are. One of the chapters in my book is about a man named Joe Sieber, who for 30 years has made his living proving that electric utilities cheat businesses and government by charging them too much money, charging them for services they didn't provide, a whole host of things, by auditing their electric bills. Well, he's particularly gone after Entergy, E-N-T-E-R-G-Y, which is the big utility that serves Louisiana, parts of Arkansas, Mississippi, and East Texas. They used a legal ruse to try and jail him. And I tell about how this judge was all set to jail him for 45 days over a letter he wrote that honestly related the dishonest practices of the company. Only because I was in the courtroom and the judge asked who the one stranger was sitting in the courtroom, did things not go quite so badly for this man? But the company's lawyer said to me, well, you know, how do we stop this guy? I mean, he's causing us terrible problems. And I looked at him and I said, well, it's really easy to stop him. It could be done in an instant. And the lawyer looks at me, you know, and he says, how? And I said, stop cheating your customers.
Well, what a concept, David K. Johnston. Again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States, the author of the bestsellers Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, and his latest book just out is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. No other company, to my mind, is a greater exemplar of the fraud of corporate America than AT&T. I had to get rid of them because I couldn't even get phone service at my own home on my cell phone. And once I called 611 to complain, and I lost the call twice while I was talking to them. And then I found out they were charging me three or four times more than Verizon, who've actually laid down some fiber optics. The whole world and most of America is already wired with fiber optics, but these monopolies control the last mile. And they don't want to invest a dime. I mean, look at AT&T. They spend all their money on lobbying in Washington and on advertising on television telling you what a great corporation they are.
Well, in California, there are 120 members of the legislature, right? 80 assembly members and 40 senators. And there are 120 AT&T lobbyists in Sacramento. I mean, that's astonishing. They have one lobbyist for every single member of the legislature. Now, five states, let's see if I can remember them all, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Alabama, Texas, and Florida, have repealed your legal right to have a landline telephone. Every American has had a right to a telephone at their address. You have to have an address. You live in the middle of a forest, they don't have to give you a telephone. But if you have a street address, by law, since 1913, you've been entitled to a telephone. When these five states repealed these laws, do you know not a single word of it appeared in any newspaper or any TV? Now, of course, if you want to know, you know, who are the Kardashian sisters kissing this week, you can find out. But something important like this, no coverage whatsoever. And they are trying to get these laws repealed everywhere. And they are putting other laws and rules in place where literally you could have telephone lines, cable line, maybe even if you're lucky, fiber optic running down your street, and they can refuse you service.
Well, but this is a form of corporate socialism, isn't it? The corporations buy the politicians, control the regulators, get the rules written their way, and the last people they care about, apparently, are the customers. They don't care about good service. They would rather advertise and tell you how great they are than actually deliver. I mean, you told the story. You said to the lawyers down there, the best way to stop harassing this guy is to actually do what you're supposed to do, which is deliver a service. What's happened to American capitalism? Are they just so fat and lazy, and the government is completely sold out, that they can just have it their way? Is that the situation?
Yeah, what you know, Citizens United illustrates this problem perfectly. The Supreme Court gave political rights to corporations and any other entity, unions, to the extent that big labor now exists. I think of it as little labor, and other organizations to involve themselves in political campaigns. The people who wrote this decision, or most of those who were on the decision, call themselves originalists. They claim they interpret the Constitution the way the founders would have. You know how many corporations existed in the United States when the Constitution was adopted? 20. There are 6 million of them today. And 14,000 of those 6 million own almost 90% of the assets. And these big companies, through their campaign contributions, through, and which they can now do directly through the companies, they don't have to go around and strong arm executives for money, through their ability to throw their weight around about jobs and other activities, are working very hard to rewrite ancient rules of business and to replace competitive markets, because there's nothing businessmen hate more than competition. Competition is terrible for profits, but it's good for the economy. That's what Adam Smith's Invisible Hand is about. That competition leads to more efficiency and greater wealth. Corporate socialism leads to a sclerotic society where a few fat cats do very, very well. And unfortunately, the news media has shrunken so much, because after all, newspapers, which do almost all the serious reporting, are, as an economic model, they're in the business of connecting buyers and sellers. You know, you're looking for a job, somebody's trying to find somebody to hire. You want to buy a used car, here's people with used cars. And as they have shrunken and their news staffs have shrunken, and in addition, those news organizations that have done tough work have come under unbelievable attack, organized attack. And the individual reporters who do good work come under attack. Trust me, I spent years being one of those people who was under that kind of attack. Then they've stopped covering these things and stopped reporting on them in a serious way. I mean, in Los Angeles, for example, you have one journalist, David Lazarus, who's a columnist for the LA Times, and to some extent Mike Hiltzik, who does a little more political work. That's about it when it comes to really seriously examining what's going on, and they are totally unmatched. I mean, just one company, AT&T, 120 lobbyists in Sacramento. So the public isn't hearing about all these little changes. And by the way, the companies aren't stupid. They don't go in and say, we want a wholesale change in the law here. They get a little change in 1990, and then they come back in 93, and they get another regulation changed you've never heard of. And then a few years later, they get a statute passed. And they put together this thing over a period of time until they have what they want, and nobody notices.
Well, you know, the next outrage by the Supreme Court will be Dodd-Frank. The corporate lobbyists who have been trying to water that down through their ownership of most of the people in Congress, they're working overtime, but they're pushing their case now to the Supreme Court, which is going to take it up. And they're likely to, the corporatists on the court, including Roberts, are likely to rule in favor of Wall Street and overturn what little teeth Dodd-Frank have left. So there's no question that they're working around the clock, and there is so little advocacy left in America for consumers and citizens. It's really shocking. And as we pointed out, just in terms of customers, the rest of the world gets infinitely better service than we get for most of our basic needs, particularly in the internet age. I wanted to ask you before we close, though, about Mitt Romney's taxes, given that we've billed you, as you've been described, as the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States, David K. Johnston. I saw you on MSNBC a couple of nights ago with an accountant who deals with wealthy offshore people who park their money, like Mitt Romney. And you were saying, and I've heard this before, that the key tax returns for Romney are the 2009 tax returns, which may show that he took the IRS amnesty as a result of the investigation into the Swiss bank and the enormous numbers of American customers they had. And the IRS apparently has been getting quite a windfall from these people who've come in from the cold. Now, we know that the return that he just released, the 2011, is fairly bogus, in as much as he could have taken bigger deductions, but he decided not to, so that his taxes would at least be as high as 14%, which is, of course, ridiculously low to begin with. The guy that you were on with said that you wouldn't know about whether or not he took the amnesty because the FBAR form is a separate entity from the...
Yes, let me deal with this. Romney, I've been calling on Romney for almost a year to release his return since 84. He gave his 1984 through 2007 returns to John McCain's campaign staff when he was being considered for vice president 4 years ago, and he required Paul Ryan to give him 10 years of returns. And, of course, his father released the abstracts of 12 years of his own returns. The 2009 return on its own would not tell you whether he got amnesty, but it would have enough hints in it that you'd be able to figure it out. The guy who was on the show is right. Technically, you want that form, and it could have been filed separately and probably was to the tax return. But the larger issue here is that venality is not the issue here. Romney may have gotten amnesty, and that would be venality on his part, which he has then corrected. The real issue is that the tax code treats working people entirely differently than people like Mitt Romney. You and I and everybody listening to this show has their taxes taken out of their paycheck or their pension check before they get the money. The government knows exactly how much money you made because your employer reports it. It knows how much you took as a mortgage interest deduction or entitled to because your bank reports it. But if you're a guy like Mitt Romney with all this offshore money, the government relies on you to tell the truth. And even if you're audited, these are such big, complicated structures that you can hide all sorts of things. And you are allowed to engage in practices around the world. In Italy, there's a big scandal over how Romney made what appears to be $60 million while paying no taxes in a business deal because he did it through an entity located in Luxembourg. And they essentially bought a company, resold it for 28 times what they paid for it, and then it fell in value back to what it used to be worth beforehand. So there really was no increase in value, and they did this almost assuredly with borrowed money. So their real return was on the order of $250 to one in a couple of years. That's the kind of thing that needs to be focused on, and how people who get these deals pay little or no tax. And Romney has done more to put a spotlight on the unfair nature of our tax system, how it is not progressive, how it violates this ancient principle of progressivity that goes back to ancient Athens, and how one of the reasons we're in so much trouble in this country is that we are getting fundamental rules wrong. Romney has been great for that, and I hope that we hear more about Romney's taxes, and don't be shocked if somebody turns up with Romney's returns before Election Day.
Well, just in closing, David K. Johnston, what's great about your book is that you've got the last chapter, you've got solutions, and they're quite comprehensive, solutions to how citizens can empower themselves. Just in the last minute, can you run us through what you've written in here as a way not to leave us wallowing despair about how we're all getting screwed, but what we can actually do about it?
Well, first of all, it's important to understand, you won't find in searching for Google what's in this book. This is all original reporting on stuff that nobody else has ever reported on. In the solutions, I explain things that are basic, simple reforms that we can do to address these problems. And two simple ones involve utilities. Every dollar that a utility company spends on seeking rate increases, and all the utilities rates around the country overall have been going up much faster than the rate of inflation, should be matched dollar for dollar with the money for the customers to challenge the rate increase, divided between industrial and commercial and residential customers for electric utilities and water utilities. That would give not a level playing field, but something closer to it, so we wouldn't have one-sided rate making. The government should go back to collecting all sorts of data that they've stopped collecting, because you can't make regulatory decisions if you don't have information. And the companies already have all this information. They're just not turning it over. We should stop hiding the locations of what we know to be the most dangerous natural gas pipelines, some of which run right underneath parks and schools. And if they were to explode, would cause massive, terrible death and destruction. And another thing we can do is we can get rid of the corporate income tax for monopolies. If you're a monopoly company, what happens now is you pay your electric bill to Southern California Edison or Con Ed in New York, and the tax money embedded in your bill often never gets to the government. It isn't just delayed for years. It, in many cases, never gets to the government. Huge amounts of time are spent by companies gaming the system to get that money and put it in their pocket permanently. Well, let's get rid of the corporate income tax for legal monopolies, and that problem goes away. Your rates will go down, and if we want the money to go to the government, we can add a tax onto the bill, and then we know the money actually goes to the government. Warren Buffett's been one of the biggest champions of trying to take tax dollars and stuff them into his own already deep pockets.
Well, David K. Johnston, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnston, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who's been called the de facto chief tax enforcement officer of the United States. His most recent books, Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch, were New York Times bestsellers. He was a reporter for the New York Times for 13 years and teaches at Syracuse University College of Law and the Whitman School of Management, and was recently elected board president of Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. His latest book just out is The Fine Print, How Big Companies Use Plain English to Rob You Blind. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Trita Parsi, who is the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. He has an article at opendemocracy.net, The U.S. and Iran on a Dead-End Path to War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Trita Parsi.
Thank you so much for having me, Ian.
And President Obama spoke at the UN today and said that the U.S. Would do what we must to stop Iran getting nuclear weapons. And yesterday, Ahmadinejad called Israel a fake regime that would be eliminated. He will speak again tomorrow. And, of course, we know that the Secretary General of the United Nations has asked speakers to tone down their rhetoric. However, I suspect that there'll be some incendiary rhetoric from Ahmadinejad tomorrow.
It would be shocking if there wasn't, unfortunately.
So here you have this reciprocity of sable rattling and bluster and bravado. Yesterday I spoke with Barbara Crissett, a veteran New York Times reporter who covered the UN. She was at the meeting that Ahmadinejad had with a group of American academics, and she said he was going on about sort of vainglorious talks about the Persian Empire and all this stuff. I mean, what's your understanding of because my understanding is that these sanctions are really biting at home and that the Iranian people are suffering. So I'm just trying to get an understanding of the disconnect between what's happening at home and the idea that he's on the world stage talking in grandiose terms.
No, the sanctions are really hurting the Iranian people and the Iranian economy. I think the Iranian economy is in shatters. Much of it is because of sanctions. Much of it is also because of incompetence and mismanagement of the economy by the government itself. Part of the reason why I'm very skeptical about the sanctions, though, is because as much as the economy is in shadows and the Iranian people are suffering, Ahmadinejad doesn't seem to be terribly bothered by it. And most importantly, the nuclear calculus of the Iranian government has not shifted a bit as a result of all of this pressure. And that's part of the reason I'm personally quite skeptical that a pressure-centric, a sanction-centric policy really can yield positive results.
So let's talk about your article that is at opendemocracy.net, the U.S. and Iran on a dead-end path to war. You're saying that there are three ways war between the United States and Iran can begin. Just walk us through that, if you could.
Yeah, if you simplify it, I think that there's approximately three different ways in which war between the United States and Iran, or Israel and Iran, could begin. And the first and obvious one is that either one of these three governments would make a decision to start a war. That the President of the United States would push the button, that the Israeli Prime Minister would do something, or that the Iranians would do something to start a war. The U.S. intelligence puts the risk of the Iranians deliberately starting a war very low. I personally don't believe that there's a high likelihood of the Israelis doing something in spite of all the rhetoric coming out of Netanyahu. I think that's more of a bluff. So far, it has been a bluff, and I think it's more likely to be a bluff going forward as well. I'm also quite convinced that the Obama administration has no interest in a military confrontation with the Iranians. U.S. military, for certain, is very much against it. And as a result, I think the first path to war, meaning a deliberate decision, is at this stage not particularly likely. Then you have, secondly, the risk of a war as a result of some sort of an incident or accident in the Persian Gulf between the U.S. and the Iranian Navy. We've seen some incidents in the past, and the U.S. military is quite concerned because we have very few de-escalatory mechanisms in place that can ensure that such an incident would not spark a larger war in the region, that it wouldn't get out of control. The risk of that is unpredictable, but it is not necessarily too small. The biggest risk, however, is the one risk that we're not talking about, the one risk that we're paying the least attention to, and that is that this pressure-centric approach that both sides are pursuing, in which they have a dual-track policy, one in which they talk to each other, but at the same time as they are negotiating, they're really putting much of their emphasis on increasing the pressure on the other side. And so far we have seen that every time one side escalates, the other one also escalates. And the danger with this is that it's extremely difficult to get out of this dynamic. And as a result, as the escalatory options become less and less and more dangerous, at some point, there's a high likelihood that the next escalatory step actually will spark a war between the two sides. It wouldn't be as much a deliberate decision to go to war, but rather that through these escalations, the situation will become so tense that it will become politically impossible to pursue any other path than continued escalation and pressure, which then eventually leads to open warfare. That's the biggest risk of war. We're essentially on a trajectory towards this type of a confrontation. I would say that the dual-track policy is a one-way street towards a confrontation. But because it's not as fast, because it doesn't appear as if we're on that path, because we believe that we're doing this pressure in order to avoid the war, we are kind of blinded by the reality that the direction that we're all heading is a gravitation towards a confrontation.
Well, Trita Parsi, you said that the United States and Iran are talking to each other. It seems that they talk past each other. And one of the things that I've always found extraordinary about the axis of evil, the David Frum phrase that became the kind of centerpiece of Bush's foreign policy, is that if you look at the three countries of the axis of evil, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea, the one thing that's pretty clear about all three countries is the United States is absolutely blind in these countries. They have no diplomatic relations, and that means you don't have anybody on the ground there really finding out what's going on. You can entirely rely on overheads from satellites and from third-party intelligence, which is often unreliable. Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs, said back in September 2011 that we've had no connection with Iran since 1979. Even in the darkest days of the Cold War, we had links to the Soviet Union. We are not talking to Iran, so we don't understand each other. If something happens, it's virtually assured that we won't get it right and that there will be miscalculation, which would be extremely dangerous in that part of the world. So don't you think that this absurd idea that we have in our diplomacy, that we'll only talk to you if you reward us by doing what we want you to do, hasn't it blinded us? We were blind going into Iraq, obviously.
Certainly the diplomacy that has taken place so far is inadequate. And I would say also that the approach to it has been highly problematic because, as I mentioned earlier on, the policy is dual track, meaning that we're doing sanctions and diplomacy at the same time. The Iranians also have a dual track policy. They talk, but at the same time, they're escalating their nuclear program. They're advancing it further. They do so primarily to put pressure on the West to essentially present the West with a fait accompli. And the West imposes more sanctions because of the belief that at some point the Iranians are going to break under all of this pressure, not realizing that for every escalatory step the West has taken, the Iranians have actually advanced their nuclear program and done exactly the things that the West would like it to cease to do, and vice versa. So this diplomacy certainly doesn't seem to qualify for what we think diplomacy should be, what the people's impression are. In these last rounds of talks, unfortunately, there were no clear indications of willingness for compromise. Particularly, the Iranians did indicate that they're willing to stop 20% enriched uranium, but from the U.S. side, there was no political readiness to engage in any sanctions relief, which is what the Iranians seem to be looking for. We'll see if after the elections, if there still is a president that is interested in diplomacy, if that president then will have the political space and maneuverability to engage in diplomacy in the manner that is necessary in order for it to yield any results.
So again, I'm speaking with Dr. Trita Parsi, who's the co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council, and he's the author of his latest book is A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. And he has an article at opendemocracy.net, The U.S. and Iran on a Dead-End Path to War. Now, recently, a very stellar group of national security luminaries signed a report by the Iran Project, which was a cost-benefit analysis of a war with Iran would involve, with former national security advisors Zbigniew Brzezinski, Brent Scowcroft, Tom Pickering, etc., former chairman of the Fed, Paul Volcker. My understanding is that one of the things that concerns some of these people is that that Netanyahu may have come to the conclusion that Obama, in spite of his efforts on through his his biggest donor, Sheldon Adelson, to keep Romney going. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly how close their friendship is, although this apparently goes back some time. But there's this notion that perhaps that Netanyahu's come to the conclusion that Obama's going to win and he's be stuck with him. So he might as well co-opt him by dragging him into a war just before the elections, which would give him an electoral boost because, as you know, we go crazy when there's a war on, and the cable news even has their own theme songs like they did for the Iraq War. And the whole country loses its mind and gets wrapped up in war fever, and that'll put Obama over the top, and therefore the Israelis will own him, and he'll be stuck with their ridiculous policy. Does that make any sense to you, that scenario?
I personally don't find it very likely that the Israelis will do something. Certainly, making the threat of taking military action does yield some benefits, but I would be very shocked if they were to do it. And I do understand the calculation that if they feel that they're stuck with Obama anyways, they might as well start something now. But that kind of disregards the tremendous opposition to military strikes that would be unilateral by the Israelis themselves from within the Israeli defense establishment, both amongst the military as well as in the intelligence. There's a tremendous amount of opposition to the idea that Israel would go it alone. It's a completely different thing if you ask them if they would like to see the U.S. take military action. But if Netanyahu does take action right now, he would be on his own. He would do it in spite of very strong messages from the United States that the U.S. does not wish to see Israel do this. And as a result, he would risk permanently damaging the most important relationship that Israel has, and that's the relationship he has with the United States.
And I don't understand, in terms of that scenario, how you could corral the U.S. into it, because it's likely if the Israelis were to attack, surely the Iranians would just ride out the attack, wouldn't they? Wouldn't it be better for them to be the victims? But if the U.S. got involved, then it could get serious, and the Straits of Hormuz could be closed, and then you'd have a global recession, could lead to a depression.
Absolutely, and that's the key thing. The likely repercussions of a war are very, very difficult to predict, and as a result, it's very difficult for Netanyahu to make such a decision when he has so little support for it politically at home. That's why I say that I think it's more likely that he's threatening and he's bluffing right now, hoping that he will yield as much, drag as much benefits as possible from the U.S. by making these threats. But the likelihood that he will actually actualize the threats, sure, I think, is relatively small.
But still, just back to your article, the U.S. and Iran on a dead-end path to war. We're talking about this as though it's insane, but you're saying it's actually quite likely. And they're on a path.
I think it's quite likely, and you know, there's a question mark in the title.
Yeah, I understand.
So it's a question that is being asked, but I do believe that it's very likely, unless we have the type of robust diplomacy that is necessary, that has succeeded elsewhere, then we are on a trajectory towards war. The status quo is not motionless. The status quo is a gravitation towards war.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Dr. Tridipassi.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, Dr. Tridipassi is co-founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of Treacherous Alliance, The Secret Dealings of Iran, Israel, and the United States, and A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. He has an article at opendemocracy.net, The U.S. and Iran on a Dead-End Path to War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back in tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.